Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Inside Scoop Live, the live audio program brought to you by ReaderViews.com. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I have invited on the program author Stephen Moss to talk about his new book called Branchwater. Stephen Moss was born in Mesa, Arizona in August of 1987. He was homeschooled until he was 15, at which point he began attending community college. In addition to his studies, he is a charter member of the Creative Writing Club and an active performer contributor to literary events on campus. Stephen currently resides in Lake Buena Vista, Florida, where he is working at a Walt Disney World cast member. Stephen began writing when he was 10. He published his first novel, a fantasy adventure titled Branchwater, in late 2007, and is nearing completion on his second book titled Madeline City, which is set for release in late 2008. Stephen writes short stories and novella-length fiction, along with poetry, as well as the occasional bit of journaling. So I'm just so happy to have Stephen on the phone today. Welcome, Stephen, to Inside Scoop Live.
Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. So really, congratulations on the publication of your first novel. You know, you're only 20 years old, right?
That's true.
So how does it feel to have your first book in print?
Really quite something. I had intended, when I got my first shipment of them, to give them all out to friends and family. It was kind of like a hype and kind of a thank you for the support and everything. But when I opened up the UPS box and like held the first copy, I was like, no, this is mine. This is the very first copy is mine. It's never going anywhere.
Yeah, right. Right.
It was pretty powerful.
Yes, yes. And then now seeing that it is available through local booksellers, you know, and online. I mean, that's pretty amazing. Anyone in the world can pick up your book now.
It is. It's where I can Google myself and actually like come up with results.
Yeah. That's great. So how long was Branchwater in the writing process and swirling around in your imagination?
Let's see. Storyline-wise, I first tried to hammer out some of the plots as a story to a video game when I was 15, when video game programming is what I wanted to do. But really, I started writing it in earnest when I was 18. And I was living in Gilbert there. And I had started living with a couple of roommates from work. And I started writing it actually when I was away from home. And I had moved back closer to my parents and continued writing it. And I had tried, you know, so many times before and had run out of steam or, you know, had just become discouraged. And it was actually after reading a couple short fiction pieces that my sister had written that I finally kind of got into my head that, you know, I can do this too, and kind of got encouraged. So finally stuck with it long enough to finish. And now it's just a lot easier now that I finished one.
The first book is basically always the hardest. It's such a learning experience, you know, so you're a much wiser individual for having done that, and I know that you're on to your second book, and I definitely want to talk to you about that later on in the interview, but I really want to focus on Branchwater right now. So really, it's a very unique setting in this novel, and this is a fantasy novel, so tell us about this land that you created and basically the setting of this book.
Well, it's set on the continent of Ezreal, which sounds very similar to Israel. I actually just, when I name things, I kind of, I'll grab a couple letters in my mind that look like they look cool on paper and throw them together, and it just kind of came out sounding like Ezreal. But the kingdom of Branchwater itself was, it went through very many name changes, and originally, my first novel was going to be set much earlier in Branchwater, but I ended up writing at a later period in Branchwater's timeline, and the history was very hard to get down, but basically it's just a kingdom of humans that used to live in and among God, sort of like a Garden of Eden setting, in the Christian sense, and except that they have like whole societies and like cities and villages, you know, and economy and everything we have today, or everything they had in medieval times, and roving in the presence of their god. Their god's council of seven advisors grew jealous, again, very biblically and Christian, you know, a lot of biblical and Christian influence here in the parents in my writing. Had a council of seven advisors that grew jealous and overthrew him. And then they set one of themselves, the leader of that council, up in the place of their god, and that sort of reversed the situation to where God had seven advisors, now his successor has six.
Okay.
And they basically power hungry, very greedy, corrupt, want only to rule and to, you know, accumulate more wealth and power while they subjugate all those around them. They kept a token small amount of the human population with them on that first continent and used the considerable power that their god had given them to create three additional continents, one of them being Israel. And they simply just told the humans, go, because, you know, we don't want you here anymore.
Wow.
And the humans forced to spread out and multiply all around the earth. And in Branchwater, it tells the tale of the small group of humans that landed on Israel and started up their kingdom and started trying to make do living in a world where they were no longer taken care of by their god. You know, they had to find their own way.
Mm.
And Branchwater is the first really serious trial of that people that several centuries, 600-700 years later, the Anahelmist has exhausted the human population that they kept back. They've had turned them into a race of slaves, pretty much, and everything that they could accomplish on the first continent there, in terms of, you know, ruling and, like, extorting the human race, has been accomplished, and now they're seeking to expand their territory to subjugate all the rest of the humans in the world to kind of reconquer those that they had once set free.
Okay. So who, then, is the Anahelmist?
The Anahelmist is the Council of Seven.
Is the
Or their leader, who now is the Council of Six.
Okay. Where did that idea come from?
The council or the name?
Both. The name, actually.
Well, the name, I can't really remember, actually. It's been a little while. But I do have kind of a flair for long, complicated words and names, and sometimes that I don't even realize myself. But I spoke with the Anahelmist because it was the first name that I came up with that kind of really flowed, and it showed some, like, uniformity. There's a lot of A's in the word, you know, so it's just like Anahelmist. It kind of flows, and only later did I realize there's a similar word in my second novel, Madeline City, but it's referring to an area of the city, not a group of people, but it's also about, you know, like 8-10 letters long, starts with an A, has like 4 A's in it, and so I guess my mind just creates words like that.
Mm-hmm. You're creating your own language here.
Somewhat.
So there is a religious side to Branchwater, and you've mentioned that already. Tell us about the religious aspect of this story and why you decided to add this into this novel.
There needed to be more to the Anahelmist than just, you know, a group of tyrants. There had to be more history to them. There had to be something that would give them credit to, you know, their reputation. And when I think of, like, a group of pretty much supernatural tyrants, one step above them, you know, would either be a more powerful, would be a more powerful supernatural force.
Mm.
And so to really give the Anahelmist more credit and to strengthen their reputation, it was, you know, it's said that at the beginning of trackable history, really, they overthrew God, which is, you know, quite a feat, and it was pretty much for that reason that religion comes into it, because after God being overthrown, the humans have no God, they have no religion. That's all a thing of the past and done away with. and is of little consequence in their present day, except only as an example to show how powerful the Anahelmists really are.
So did you take specific biblical references, or is this more of kind of fictitious biblical reference?
It's really pretty fictitious. I'm speaking for myself. I mean, I don't agree with the possibility of God being overthrown and everything I write about, but that is what happens in Branchwater, and that is how things pan out. I think the very few really biblical reference, like specific ones, the God-maintaining Council of Seven, you know, seven being a very biblical number, and then six being the opposite, like a rather satanic reference in many respects.
Yeah.
There's that sort of, although that's never, you know, it's never said in those words in the novel, it's just sort of a detail thrown in there that can be appreciated by those who recognize it. And then a few of the names of the members of the Anahelmists, even though there's only, I think, two or three mentioned in Branchwater, I do have all seven of them named, and one of them, actually the final, the seventh one, I was having trouble coming up with a name for, and eventually settled on a name taken out of the Book of Nehemiah, the leader of the Jews who were opposed to Nehemiah's effort of rebuilding the wall, thereby saving Jerusalem. And that's pretty much, and actually that even that name escapes me right now. I'm sure it starts with C.
That's interesting. So the humans, they end up living in peace with their guardians, which is just an interesting aspect of this story, and they're called the Mantlik.
Yes.
So tell us about them and set up this aspect of the story.
When the humans originally arrived on Ezrael, there's a couple of references throughout the book that the land is tainted, that it's like evil, that it's got kind of a shadow over it because it was created by the Anahelmists, by such evil, you know, by such evil forces. There are a few, like, in the mountains to the east, there's a few times references made to dangerous creatures, dangerous, like, substances. When they first arrived, there were a race of these great-scaled, really large reptilian creatures that lived in tunnels beneath the ground, and they came up and would, you know, attack the humans, and they're, like, really, like, large four-legged creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And there was these kinds of things that necessitated the humans defending themselves somehow, and having been dumped on the shores of this new continent with, like, little else, they used what power they had been given by God to create this second race meant solely for their protection. Later they come to find out they, like, as the generations of humans move on, as further generations are born, their power wanes and starts to dissipate, and they realize that it was only because of in the presence of God they had that sort of power, and the further they get from God, then the less power they have. And really, by the time Branchwater takes place, they're not creating life at all anymore. They've lost the ability and the skill, and it's just the Mantlik themselves propagating themselves.
Mm. Now, what kind of, what are your thoughts, and what kind of research did you do on the whole reptilian aspect and the underground communities or people living, these creatures living underground? Because, you know, there's actually a lot of people that believe in reptilian races and underground beings and that sort of thing. So where do you stand on all of that, or is this just purely fantasy novel?
Well, it is purely fantasy novel, but it is inspired by a great many things, too.
Mm-hmm.
From things just as just as fictitious, movies like Reign of Fire and The Cave, where there have been, like, dragons, you know, living underground for centuries and millennia and stuff. To like you say, like, rumors and belief systems that there are, like, things living down there, like, at the core of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Not much of my inspiration tends to come from fact. But certainly, I go out in Arizona, so there's lots of reptilian creatures out there, and quite a few. I don't know why the horny toad just comes to mind right now.
Mm-hmm.
And there are quite a few that, while they don't all, like, live underground or take to the ground because of the heat. They'll stay in the shadows all the time, and they just watch with those blank reptilian eyes that convey absolutely no emotion. And it's just that sort of creepy, watchful gaze from the shadows that is supposed to be conveyed through this reptilian race in Branchwater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, we hear about reptilian races and humans actually have that reptilian part of their brain. So, you know, I just wanted to know how much influence that sort of thought went into your book. So who are the driving characters of Branchwater?
The driving characters are mostly all Mantwicks except for one human. Two, but mainly one, named Kindersley, and he's a rather unskilled and somewhat unlucky castle sentry, and he's actually the first human to spot the first army that appears south of Branchwater Castle, and as such, he's kind of brought to the forefront of things in a way that he never would have been, you know, if someone else had spotted, you know, the army first. He tags along with the Mantwicks that come to the castle. Once the army is sighted, they send the Mantwicks and use the characters that they use between the humans and themselves. The what's it called? No word. The like ambassadors. The two peoples do would have like all together and joined, like integrated. That is, and but they do have the certain, you know, like Mantwicks that interact with the kings and the queens and stuff like that. One that they use is Greta. She's one of the oldest Mantwicks. She's a dueling champion that has not lost a battle in the their yearly tournaments. She has not lost a battle in hundreds of years, and she's, as I said, the undefeated champion. She has lots of recognition. She's quite a public figure, but she's also very, not quiet or reserved, but she's very respectful, and she's very caring. Her son is another one of the characters that comes along with her to the castle once things really start, you know, heating up. Mm-hmm. And his name's Hugo. He pretty much assists on the soldiers up on the wall and helps coordinate their efforts, while Greta maintains a more, not withdrawn, but a more administrative role. She carries messages between the Mantwick lord, that's the lord of the forest they live in, and the human king, and coordinates the efforts between the two peoples.
Mm-hmm.
Her niece, Desiree, is not supposed to leave the forest at all. She's very young, as Mantwicks go, and is supposed to be staying at home, and she tags along anyway. And when she does, by the time she does, the situation is dangerous enough that she can't leave the castle town. And as much as Greta doesn't like it, she needs to stay within the walls that are under siege. And it's her that ultimately discovers and stumbles upon not the reptilian race living underneath the ground, but the entrance to those tunnels and the person that facilitates that introduction.
Yeah, she's a very important character.
She is. Not only because of her discovery there, but also because of powers that she has that no one else realizes except for the prince of the kingdom. And that's the king's brother. And the prince is quite astute, and he's very, I don't think snooty is the right word, but he's very high and mighty.
Mm-hmm.
And, but when he recognizes this power in Desiree, he is immediately very respectful of her in a way that he is not respectful of anyone else. Everyone else, you know, he spends so much time reading and learning and researching, and you know, considers himself to be so much more knowledgeable in everything than anyone else. And when he sees that Desiree has this potential, he immediately respects her and takes her under his wing and shares. While he doesn't have the skill that she does, he shares the knowledge that he has concerning it.
Interesting.
And we'll be back with
more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Did you know that audiobooks are the fastest growing publication in the book publishing industry with over $1 billion in sales annually? And did you know that over 40 million audiobooks were sold last year? This clearly shows that millions of avid readers enjoy listening to books in their cars, while at work, traveling, and even while exercising or walking. Not only that, many individuals with vision issues rely on audiobooks to access the literary world. If you are an author interested in taking the next step with your book and tapping into an entirely new audience, we can help you turn your manuscript into a professionally produced audiobook. Visit us at readerviews.com and click on the Services for Authors tab in the top menu bar. There you will find a list of services we provide, plus a link to get the information you need to turn your work into an audiobook. The potential of the audiobook has been proven and may just be the ideal next step for you in promoting your masterpiece. Go to readerviews.com today.
And now back to Inside Scoop Live with your host, Juanita Watson.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm speaking with Stephen Moss, author of Branchwater. You can find out more about Stephen through his website, www.humansandmantlix.com. How much battle scenes do you have? Is the whole battle aspect a big part of this novel?
It is. Really the story is of Branchwater as a kingdom and the troubles and struggles that it faces, and it is about individual people as well, but it deals mostly with the fact that the Anahelmists want to take over the kingdom as a whole. They want to conquer this group of humans, and so the warfare is a big aspect of it. There's quite a substantial amount of battle scenes as the conflict escalates and like ramps up, because the first army just kind of they start out slow. You know, they bring their army in and they charge the walls, and the next day they bring in a siege tower, and the next day they bring in 3 and then 8 and then 12. You know, it escalates as they unload their armies and stuff from the river down south.
So would this be a good novel for a young adult reader, or is this more adult-oriented?
It would be, it's actually very comparative to Lord of the Rings, in that there's a good bit of violence, fair amount of blood, there's no sexuality or language, but there is that, you know, there's that violence aspect, that gritty, that not violence for violence sake, but this is what's happening, and I'm going to write it down. So there's plenty of death sequences, both general and personalized, and I don't think quite as gut wrenching as say Boromir's death in Lord of the Rings, but certainly
close.
It's not, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, fantasy novels really from what I understand, I've never written a book, but from what I understand, the fantasy genre is one of the most complex genres to write, and I'm wondering how, I mean, you really kind of wrote this book in a short amount of time, how you kept everything flowing cohesively, you know, when you're talking about creating a new language and all, you know, new origins of beings and a complete new setting. How did you just work that all in a cohesive manner?
Well, it is difficult, but at the same time, when you have enough ideas, they tend to fall together,
mm-hmm.
Provided they're all the same kind of idea.
Mm-hmm.
I would start out, like I said, I first had the idea for the story when I was 15, so I've had ample time to, you know, kind of flesh it out and develop it in my mind, if not on paper, and, what I generally do is just write an outline of the first couple steps for the book, but never like plan it out.
No pegboards and papers all over your wall or anything like that.
Actually, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I love big, thick, fat file of different notes and stuff, especially when all the books, all the eventual books in the series, all their notes are jammed together as well. And I have maps of the continents and of the towns and stuff, like 4 and 6 pieces of paper taped together and scrawled all over. It is a lot of material to deal with and to organize, but I find the more I do it, the easier it is to recognize quickly, like, which bits fit and which bits don't, and to just, like, start, you know, like, attempting to add stuff on the fly, or build up to big actual events and stuff. It becomes easier to recognize what's going to work and what's not going to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit of trial and error, but with the skill applied to recognize what will work and what won't.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that this is going to be a series. How many books do you plan on writing?
In the Branchwaters series, 4 total. Branchwaters the first, and then 3 more following it, all kind of, I guess, chronicling. If that's the correct usage of that word, I should know.
Mm-hmm.
Telling the tale of the Kingdom of Branchwater and its struggles against the Anahamas as they return time and again and make a bid for the control of the continent. Other than those books, I have a million more stories somewhere.
So this is going to be a lifelong journey for you in writing?
Yes, I certainly plan it that way.
That's great. Well, I know you're working on your second book, which actually isn't a follow-up to Branchwater. It's completely unrelated.
Yes. That one, called Madeline City, is about, as opposed to a kingdom, it's about a city. But it's also very, actually more so religiously, not inspired, but involving. It's Madeline is actually the name of a goddess that used to rule over this city, and in Madeline City, actually, the case isn't that her people rose up and did away with her. It is that her people drifted away and stopped worshiping her, stopped paying attention, took her for granted, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another very biblically inspired thing, much like the Israelites kept turning away time and time again. The citizens of Madeline City did this, and Madeline, being, she is a goddess of love and caring, and being as such, she let them have their way, and when they no longer wanted her around, she up and left. And her church, in her absence, grew corrupt, and they rose up and killed the king and took over in his stead, only not nearly, but like covertly. It was like an inner coup. And only like 50 or so years later could people look back and realize that all this was planned, that the church took advantage of the goddess' absence, killed the king, and are now, same as Branchwater, ruling as tyrants. And it's the story, basically, of just a couple bums from the poorest, one of the poorer districts of the city that get caught up in the, the plans and the schemes of the rebellion, and very much against their will, but they run into a member of the rebellion while fleeing the churchmen for something, you know, that they've done, and being forced to work with the rebellion, and then might as well work with them some more, and then being drug into it, and it's very much not what they want, but they have to work with it, but eventually, as they fight together with the rebellion, they come to appreciate and even befriend many members of the rebellion. But the book deals mainly with these two bums that get caught up in kind of a whirlwind of events.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like that there are some common themes that go through your writing, like the biblical influence,
mm-hmm.
The tyranny aspect, the rebellion, and standing up for what's right and that sort of thing. So are those statements that you're wanting to convey, or is this just kind of how your first novels are unfolding?
I don't really consider them to be statements made by me. One of my teachers back in Arizona always maintained that writers tend to be obsessed with the same sorts of subjects, and which is how, and as are musicians, just they play only in their style, and it's how performers or writers develop a reputation, a following, and their own style, is that, there's a certain sort of thing that Stephen King writes about all the time. There's a certain sort of thing that Dean Koontz does.
Sure.
Certainly, John Grisham always has, commonalities. And some of them I don't even realize until, halfway through a book, and I'm like, hey, this is kind of like in Bridgewater, but when this, or when I'm, writing a story, I won't even recognize them. It's just, I suppose, the way that I think, or just those kinds of ideas come easily to me, and so I just end up writing about them again and again in some form or another.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's great. So when will Madeline City be out on shelves?
Madeline City, either late 2008 or early 2009. Hopefully not as late as 2009, but... And so I'm living in Florida right now, and for the next 3 months now. At that time, I'll have to transition back to Arizona and find work there again and start going to school again.
You're a busy guy.
Yeah, and I only half enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
I like to take my time with everything, but at the same time, it's hard to get anything done unless you're really motivated and
disciplined.
So hopefully 2008.
Great.
At the very latest, the spring of 2009.
Great. So do you have any advice for first-time authors?
I would say most definitely go to school. Probably even before that, try to find friends that are also writers. Try to meet other writers, although maybe that's best accomplished by going to school. It's really cool. You can... Well, what I basically did for Branchwater, I had little to no... schooling, in the field of writing. I just like to watch movies and read books, and I just really like a great story. And so I tried to model, the plot and the structure of Branchwater just kind of like around the plot of a good movie, in terms of like how the action builds up and how there's like low points and then like the final battle kind of deal. And only later, after going to school, did I realize and learn that there is a set structure of six steps that all stories include. And it doesn't matter what kind of story it is, the musical Grease has all six of the same story steps that Texas Chainsaw Massacre does.
Mm-hmm.
And and that just shows that even though there are six set steps that every story includes, there are endless possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And just knowing that and many, many other things that I had no idea about helps in writing a more cohesive, involving plot and better fleshed out characters, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Great. What's your website, Stephen?
It's www.humansandmanwix.com. It is right now tailored just after Branchwater, although I am in the middle of revamping it, and so it will include my future works. When I started it up, I just had the single book Branchwater, but as it gets closer to Madeline City's release, then I'm going to have to work in with it a little bit.
Put more information up there.
Yeah.
Definitely. So can your book be purchased on your website, or is it just through the online and local booksellers?
It can be purchased off my website, as well as any big bookseller, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and like BooksAMillion.com. I found it on like Irish bookselling websites and stuff too. So,
that's great.
Anywhere on the web.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for coming on the program, Stephen.
Absolutely, thank you.
It's been great talking with you. Congratulations and much success to you with Branchwater. And I hope to have you back when you come out with Madeline City.
I hope to be back.
Great. Well, you take care.
You too.
Thank you so much. Thank you. All right. There you go, listeners. I've been talking with Stephen Moss. His first and newest novel, Branchwater, is available through local and online booksellers. His website, once again, www.humansandmantlix.com. manticlikes.com, and that's M-A-N-T-L-I-K-S. So check it out. Get in on the first novel of this budding new author. So thanks so much for listening to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.